Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The bond between humans and dogs goes back thousands of years. They're loyal, obedient, and affectionate. Dogs are truly humans' best friend. But do they love us as much as we love them? What's going on behind those watchful eyes? What are they really thinking? Dr. Gregory Burns is a neuroscientist at Emory University in Atlanta, and he's studied the inner workings of the canine brain and other brains. He is the author of several books on the human-dog connection. His newest book is entitled What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. Dr. Burns joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
You're a neuroscientist. Most people think, well, you must study the human brain. How did you get interested in studying the dog brain?
Well, I used to study the human brain. Actually, for most of my career, I spent using MRI to study reward systems in human brains, kind of what makes us tick, what motivates us. And what happened was, it was probably now about 7 years ago or so, one of my favorite dogs, who was a pug named Newton, passed away at the age of 15, so he lived a very full life. Mm-hmm. And I think probably in the back of my mind, I wondered what he had thought of me. You know, he was my favorite dog, and I started thinking about, well, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could use the same tools that we use in humans to study dogs, to see what they're thinking and how their brains tick. And the actual catalyst was the Bin Laden mission. And so I had been rather oblivious to the whole military working dog scene. And with all the publicity around that mission, there was a dog on the team, and I saw these pictures of dogs jumping out of helicopters, and that was kind of when the light bulb turned on in my head. It's like, wow, if dogs can be trained to jump out of helicopters, then of course we could train dogs to go into an MRI machine, and you know, they'd be completely awake, not sedated, no restraints, and then we could really see what makes them tick.
Yeah, I'm kind of amazed. How many dogs have you studied with the MRI machine at this point? How many have been involved?
So we started with two dogs. So one was the replacement for the dog who died. So that was a little terrier named Callie, and she had joined our household. And that was back now probably in 2012. We had we worked with a dog trainer to mm-hmm. figure out how to do this. And now, 6 years later, we've trained and scanned over 90 dogs.
What's the trick to training them to do this? You're asking them to do something pretty special.
Yeah. So, you know, in hindsight, it's not as hard as it sounds. So there's a couple of tricks. So the first is figuring out what might bother dogs about the MRI. So humans don't like MRI machines as a general rule. Mm-hmm. Lots of people find them claustrophobic because, you know, you have to go in this tube, and they're really loud. So if you haven't had an MRI, they sound like jackhammers when they're running. And so the trick was, the things that bother people are not necessarily the things that bother dogs. So the dogs aren't generally claustrophobic. They don't have any problems crawling into tight spaces. But the noise does bother them, for sure. And so the tricks were to isolate kind of all the elements. I built simulators of MRIs and practiced at home. So I, you know, we built these tubes that dogs can practice in, and built mock-ups of the receiver coil that picks up the signals from the brain. And then we made audio recordings of the sounds that the scanner makes, and then just played them around the house while playing with the dogs. And it just kind of eventually became background noise to the dogs. So a lot of it is just getting the dogs used to all the elements in environments that they're comfortable with, especially when you play with them and feed them. So the idea is to make these things that seem foreign not foreign and actually fun for the dogs. I know it sounds weird, but it works.
You know, I was thinking about it that I've had dogs. I've had a lot of dogs. I grew up with them. Ultimately, every dog is different. I mean, isn't there sort of a kind of automatic selection going on when you only can do this on dogs that can be trained to do this?
Of course. And so, you know, after the project got rolling and we were convinced that this would work and that the dogs would hold still and not be terrified and actually have fun, we put out kind of the word in the dog community here in Atlanta that, hey, we're looking for people and dogs to volunteer for this project, and we're going to train your dogs and help you train your dogs to do this, and, you know, to try to figure out what the dogs are thinking. So, of course, there's a self-selection going on here. So it selects for people who are interested in this stuff and have the time available to do the training. And then, of course, it selects for the dogs who are comfortable with these sorts of things. So as the project rolled on, we developed a tryout process. And so every time we were ready to start training a new group, we would hold tryouts for people to come and see if their dogs would enjoy doing this. And so the tryouts are fairly straightforward, and we just kind of go through many of the elements that the dogs will learn to make sure that they're not scared by any of them. Because if they're scared, then it's not going to be enjoyable for anyone. And so we politely, you know, send people on their way and say, you know, we don't think your dog would actually have fun doing this. So in the end, we are left with people who are motivated to do this and dogs who are calm and comfortable enough with the elements, for sure.
And then, of course, the ultimate question, what's it like to be a dog? The question is, how do you know that what a dog, however their brain is lighting up when it comes to an MRI, it means the same thing as it does when a human's brain lights up?
Yeah, so that's the million-dollar question, and that is really, that question motivates why I wrote my latest book. So kind of the backstory to that question is that there was a very famous philosophical essay written now about 40 years ago, which was called, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And the essence of the argument by the philosopher who wrote that was, well, we can never know what it's like to be a bat because we're not bats. If you want to know what it's like to be a bat, you'd have to be a bat. And then if you were a bat, you couldn't tell us because you wouldn't have language. So you get kind of very quickly into this kind of circular logic that it's impossible to know what it's like to be an animal. But the same argument applies to people. So, and I've heard this argument as well. Mm-hmm. You can say, well, you don't know what it's like to be me, and I don't know what it's like to be you because you would have to be me to know what it's like. And so, again, you kind of fall into these kind of logical traps. So the way I see it is that, in fact, when it comes to people, we actually really do know what it's like to be another person to a high degree. Is it 100%? No. But we probably have a very good idea of, because human experience is by and large very universal. We have the same body types. You know, we know what sensations feel like. Our cultures are very similar. And so, you know, to 95, 99%, I probably do know what it's like to be another person. And in some cases, we know even better than the person themselves what they're experiencing. So then the question then comes to animals. Well, what can we know what it's like to be about an animal? Because they can't speak to us and tell us what they're thinking. So that's where the brain imaging comes in. So the way I see it, you know, when you start looking at animals' brains, you immediately notice the similarities and differences. And so I've chosen to focus largely on the things that are similar across brains. So we can look in a dog brain and we can identify structures that human brains have. And that makes sense because of the continuity of evolution. We're all mammals and we're all derived from kind of the same crown mammals from hundreds of millions of years ago. So then with the dogs, what we do is, so when the dogs are in the scanner, we do experiments, essentially the same versions of what we've done in humans. And so we can reference. So when we do an experiment on a human and we see activity in a particular part of the brain and they're experiencing something because they can tell us, and then we do the same thing in dogs and we see the same part or the analogous part of their brain active, I draw the inference that, hey, they're probably experiencing something similar to what the humans are experiencing, but just without the words to label it.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, absolutely. So we focus on the reward systems of both human and dog brains. That's because that's what I trained on, and that's what I know in humans. And so that structure is a series of structures called the caudate nucleus. And so this structure has the highest concentration of dopamine receptors in the brain. And so we know that this structure is generally active in people when they're anticipating something good and something important is about to happen. So So you see it in humans when you present people with things that they like. So if you signal that, hey, they're going to win some money, or even when they hear music that they like, or they see pictures that they like, all the things that we like generally activate the structure, and it's associated with this positive anticipation. Okay, so we can then do this in dogs. So in our early experiments, we trained the dogs after they were trained for the scanner. We trained them on various signals. Initially, we used hand signals, where one hand signal means hold still and you're going to get a piece of food in 10 seconds. And then another hand signal means nothing. Nothing's going to happen. So when we do that and we compare the response of these two hand signals, we see activity in this very same structure indicating that the dogs have this positive association to this hand signal, meaning that we've created this positive anticipation, and we know that they like hot dogs. So that was the very first thing we did. And that just kind of was a proof of concept that this technique works in dogs, and we can interpret fairly obviously that dogs like treats. Okay, that's just showing that it works. Then we did some later experiments, and then we asked the question, well, is the dog human bond all about food? And so for that experiment, we did something similar, except we also added a condition where a different signal meant that the human would pop into view and just say, hey, good girl, and just kind of have this social reward, no food involved. And what's interesting about this is, again, very similar to humans. You know, humans respond the same way to positive social rewards. So we saw in dogs, the majority of dogs had equal responses in the structure to both food and praise, and many of the dogs had even a greater response to the praise itself, which tells us that this association of dogs to humans is not just about the food, but they also kind of have this intrinsic reward to just the bond itself. And I would say that this is kind of strong evidence that the dogs have these positive emotions for humans, and it's not just based on food.
My guest is Dr. Gregory Burns. He's a neuroscientist at Emory University. He is the author of several books. The latest is entitled What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. Listeners, if your dog could talk, what do you think they'd say to you? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a question for Dr. Burns, of course, you're welcome to share your question or comment with Dr. Burns. Stay with us. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the minds of dogs and what really goes on behind their watchful eyes. Still with us is Dr. Gregory Burns. He's director of the Center for Neuropolicy and a professor at Emory University's Computation and Cognitive Neuroscience Lab. His new book is entitled What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. What does the actual testing look like when you look at a brain of a dog versus a brain of a human, Dr. Burns? What's the difference?
Well, so the brains, there's a size difference, obviously, or maybe maybe not obviously, but a human brain is about the size of, I don't know, maybe a small soccer ball or a big grapefruit, whereas a dog's brain varies in size, maybe up to the size of a lemon at the biggest. So there's a size difference, but that's actually not the most interesting part. So the interesting parts are what parts of the brain have expanded and contracted in the various species. So in humans, we have a very large prefrontal lobe, presumably because that's related to all of the things that we plan, it's related to language and kind of all the very uniquely human stuff. Dogs do not have as big a frontal lobe, but of course they also have larger portions of their brain devoted to smell. than we do. So those are kind of the obvious differences.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is kind of all scaffolded on kind of a core set of structures that it looks essentially the same in both species. And so that's a lot of where we've focused our attention on kind of these areas that are core to really all mammals. And I think actually have a lot to do with animal emotions. And I think that's critical for that.
Let's see. Mike in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Anne. Hi, Dr. Burns. Let me tell you, my friend, Dr. Burns, I really appreciate the work you're doing. Personally, I can't imagine going through life without the companion of a canine. One of the things, I just wanted to hear your response to this. Years ago, I read a book entitled The Canine Clan, and in the foreword, Conrad Lorenz commented about how he'd watched his two German shepherds rip apart a deer and then later come in and then play with his grandchildren on the floor, and just how dogs sort of, they must see us as something like them. I wondered if you thought that human cognition and our emotions are similar to dogs because we're both pack hunters and we're, I guess, to a large degree, social carnivores. Now, why is it that humans and dogs seem to be so emotionally compatible? I'll hang up and take your answer off the air.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, I think that's actually a great question, and it's something that I've actually thought a great deal about, because it's when you think about it, it's kind of curious that the first animal that humans domesticated and started living with was a fellow carnivore. So you might think that we were competitors way back.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something very interesting about that. And I don't know if it's because of the carnivore part, or probably more related to the fact that we're both, when you're talking about both, talking about wolves now, that we're both very social species and we live in large social groups. One of the things that we've studied more recently in the dog project is actually how dogs respond to faces, human faces as well as dog faces. So there's this very interesting finding in the human and primate literature that we've known this for 20 years, that there's specific parts of the human brain as well as other primates that respond only to faces. So it seems like this part of the brain is dedicated to processing faces, which makes sense for us humans because faces carry a great deal of information and they're very important to us. Now, dogs are interesting because they also look at our faces, and they're fairly unique in doing that, because most other species, if you look at them, it's usually taken as a threat of some sort. So dogs have somehow evolved this ability to look at us in ways that are not perceived as threats. So we did an experiment with the MRI dogs where we showed them pictures in the scanner of human faces, pictures of dog faces, and as control stimuli, we showed them pictures of everyday objects and natural scenes. And what's amazing is, just like our brains, we found a dedicated part of their brain just for faces, and it turns out that it's in essentially the same area. It's in an analogous part of the visual system. And so we think there's some debate about whether this is just because they live with us and they become accustomed to faces, or whether it's deeply evolved, perhaps going all the way back in the wolf line. But it's a core similarity, I would say, speaking to this issue.
Jared in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Gregory Burns. Hi, Jared.
Hi, Anne and Dr. Burns. Dr. Burns, your book is titled What It's Like to Be a Dog, and I'm wondering, is that a reference to a pretty famous paper in philosophy of mind called What It's Like to Be a Bat?
Yeah.
Yes, it is, absolutely. So, and my book is titled as a statement, not a question, because I think we have enough information now to understand what it's like to be another animal.
Thanks a lot, Jared, for that call. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Callers, if your dog could talk, what do you think they'd say? Do you have ideas about that? Give us a call. Dr. Burns, can you talk about how far back our relationship with dogs does go?
Well, that's one of the great mysteries here. So there's some debate about this. There's kind of two lines of information. One is from the fossil record, and then probably the more useful one now is genetics. And so genetic analysis of modern dogs and wolves is suggesting that dogs have been with us for at least 15,000 years. Now, this is important because the first human settlements only date to about 11,000 years ago. So that means the dogs were with humans at least for several thousand years before humans started agriculture and making cities. And the reason this is important is because previously it was generally thought that wolves started hanging around human settlements and scavenging off of human garbage, and that the most tame of the wolves eventually became dogs. So if dogs predate that, then that means that something happened with essentially nomadic hunter-gatherers. And we don't really know what that is. There's kind of these missing links between modern wolves and dogs, but the important thing is it predates agriculture.
Are they smarter than we think they are?
Well, I guess it depends kind of on who you ask, because I'm always amazed at how smart they are. I think with dogs, one of their great skills is actually their social intelligence. So, you know, that's what makes them so great and special to all of us dog lovers, is the ease with which they can adapt themselves to living with another species and in different environments. And that's probably the thing that distinguishes them from wolves, who obviously cannot live with us, and we wouldn't want that.
Alex in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I would like to ask Dr. Burns a question about, I often hear that people get to look like, and dogs get to look like their person. And so I was wondering if he has any thoughts on that. What people and owners look like the same?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't really have much to say on that topic, although it has been noted by many authors.
Okay. Do dogs pick us as much as we pick them? Do we know if they have a choice in their mind?
I don't know. One of the projects I would like to do going forward is better understanding of what makes for a strong dog-human relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I have several dogs at home now, and, even though I'm not supposed to say this, I have favorites. I like some of them better than others. I don't know if that feeling is mutual, because only one of the dogs is trained for the MRI, but I think it's a great question.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. What has surprised you in your research studying dog brains? What kind of upended previous notions?
Well, I think the experiment we were talking about with food and praise is very surprising, and in many ways reassuring to us dog lovers that they seem to intrinsically like things about humans, not just for food. I think one of the other things that surprised me is it was only observable when we started training larger numbers of dogs for this, and that is how different each of the dogs are. So, we've been talking about, well, dogs' brains are like this, or dogs kind of behave like this, as if dogs are just one thing. But the fact is, dogs are like humans in the sense that they're individuals. They have different personalities. They have different motivations. They have different likes and dislikes. And when we start looking at how their brains react to the various things that we present to them, we see that play out. And it's remarkable, because it ends up correlating with many aspects of their personality and their temperament. And we can see it kind of playing out in their brains. And it's pretty amazing.
Can you give me an example of that?
So we did another experiment on what we call impulse control. And so the idea with impulse control, this was motivated by the famous marshmallow test that was developed in the 60s. So the marshmallow test was done in children, typically around age 4 or 5. And the idea was the child was put into a room, and they were told that if you wait 15 minutes, you'll get a cookie or a marshmallow. And so the person leaves the room, and then if the child doesn't feel like waiting, they can ring a bell, and then they'll come back and they'll get something, but not as desirable as the marshmallow or the cookie. So this became a measurement or a test of delayed gratification or some kind of self-control. And what's interesting about that test is that the kids who could delay gratification ended up years later doing just much better in life. They had higher SAT scores, they earned more money, they just flourished in society much better than the kids who had no impulse control at all. Okay, so we developed a version of that for the dogs, and it's obviously not that, but it involved requiring the dogs to inhibit a specific motor response. So we taught the dogs that when they heard a dog whistle, that they needed to touch their nose to a little target that we put in front of them, so they nose poked it. That's relatively easy to train. Then after they learned that, we taught them a new hand signal that said that meant don't touch the target even when you hear the whistle. So the idea was they had to inhibit that impulse to, you know, nose poke. That actually took many months to teach the dogs that. But when we put them in the scanner, and the idea was to see what parts of their brain were active when they were putting on the brakes doing impulse control, what we found was a part of their frontal lobes, which turns out to be analogous to the same part of the frontal lobes that humans do during that task. And the dogs who had more activity there, meaning they were deploying more of their brain to put on the brakes, did better on the task, and they also did better on other tasks of impulse control outside the scanner. And so we kind of captured the whole range of this ability, which also ended up tapping into their personalities. It was amazing.
We have an email from Barb. She says, do you have any recommendations for helping our 2-year-old golden retriever after the recent death of our 14-and-a-half-year-old golden retriever? She seems a little sad. She seems to cling to me a lot more, and she is really trying to get the cat to play with her. The cat is not going for it.
Yeah, that's tough. I've been there as well.
They grieve then, you think?
For lack of a better word, yes. You know, it's clear, you know, that they form relationships not only with us but with other members of the household. It doesn't mean that they like all other dogs or all other animals. Mm-hmm. And I do think that they have favorites and they miss them when they're gone.
And so how do you comfort a dog?
Well, I mean, it's like, how do you comfort a human mm-hmm. in that situation? It's kind of one of these things, you know, that it takes time. And there's no easy process to it. You know, I guess you can get another dog. I know it's not much solace, but that's...
I don't know if that's what Barb wanted to hear.
Yeah.
Let's see. Jim in Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi. My question concerns a friend of mine. She has a service dog. It is a German Shepherd breed. And a very friendly dog, and I understand that the process of service dogs is they belong to their masters only. However, one day I was in the park where we share some downtime on our jobs, and the dog came up to me and put his head in my lap, and I instinctively started to massage behind his ears. I took a massage course some years ago, and he now, every time he sees my car coming into the park when she is there, he runs up to meet my car. He sits down, instinctively is telling me, you know, massage my head, massage my back. And the dog just so enjoys this. And I've developed such a relationship, you know, with this dog that's not even mine. How does that relate to animals and people? Is that question clear?
Well,
So I'm not sure that there's a specific question there, though I can tell you about a different experiment that we did last year. So one of the things that we did with the dog project is we actually spun off a side project to specifically study service dogs, actually service dogs, dogs in training to become service dogs. And so we used one of the tasks that we had developed in adolescent dogs who were beginning their advanced training. And the idea was we had this idea that maybe there was something in the brains of these adolescent dogs who would eventually become good service dogs versus those who weren't. And what we found is, yes, there is. And what's interesting about it is that we found that the reward system was more active in the dogs who eventually became good service dogs. And we think that that reflects that they were perhaps, they had higher levels of motivation to work and do these things than the dogs who essentially washed out. The other thing, though, that I think is even more interesting is we focused on another structure called the amygdala, which is known to be critically involved in what we call physiologic arousal, meaning that's kind of when your body gets jacked up, which could be either from fear and anxiety, or similar things happen when they're excited. And so we found that actually to be a negative indicator of the dogs, suggesting that dogs who were more excitable were not good service dogs. So there is clearly something going on here that we can pick up. Now, I don't know, maybe the dog that you've made friends with is not a good service dog if they like you that much. So that would be just a hypothesis. I don't know.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. You are listening to a conversation with Dr. Gregory Burns. He's a neuroscientist at Emory University and the author of several books. His latest is entitled What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. We'll continue our conversation. You have question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the mind of the dog, what really goes on behind those watchful eyes. Still with us is Dr. Gregory Burns. He's director of the Center for Neuropolicy and a professor at Emory University's Computation and Cognitive Neuroscience Lab. He's the author of a new book as well. It's entitled What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How good are dogs at reading human emotions? You've talked about how they are wired to process human faces. And I remember when we were kids, this sounds horrible, but when we were kids, we had a dog. She was a standard poodle, and we would pretend like we were crying so that she would come up and lick our faces and try to make us feel better. What was she doing?
it's impossible to say because, yeah. And I, you know, we haven't studied this, but other people are attempting to study it. And the basic problem with these studies is if you actually do a controlled study, then the people are faking the responses. And so dogs act curious, and they may just be reacting to kind of the weirdness of the situation, and it's possible they can perceive that it's not genuine. So much of that research is very unclear whether they actually can empathize with us, because I think that's what people want to know, is whether, you know, in some ways they have empathy when we feel sad, that they also feel sad.
Mm-hmm.
So far, there's not any evidence for that. They do detect kind of the changes in our behavior and acting like that, though.
Marianne in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Marianne.
Hi, Ann, thanks. Dr. Burns, we know that humans have a wide range of intelligence, and I know I've had some very smart dogs and some that were dumb as rocks. And I wondered if you've noticed a wide range of intelligence among dogs and if your favorite dog is smart.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, as I was saying before, I mean, one of the things that we're seeing is just kind of the variation in brain responses in dogs that are trained for MRI. We don't really study intelligence because in part, it's very hard to define what we mean by intelligence, you know, and it depends entirely on the context. And so one of the issues in intelligence testing in dogs is you have to teach the dogs how to do the test before you can do the test, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So that is also a confounding factor. But that said, I have no doubt that there's kind of a range of abilities, just like in humans.
Thanks, Marianne. Jeffrey in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hello, Dr. Burns. I hope this question doesn't sound adversarial, but what I want to ask you about is a history of scientific bias in the study of animals, which, when assuming what is a thought to be an objective position, think about Jane Goodall's violation of all the objective requirements at that time. We discard history, a whole history of practical knowledge accumulated by dog trainers and dog owners, and in order to get a black box situation, and therefore many, many years are spent with apparent scientific results like dogs don't feel emotions, and now we know they do. Dogs don't smile. Dogs, you know, and so the idea of a neuroscience seems to be still very far behind the accumulated knowledge of practical science, yet the status of neuroscience seems to put all of its conclusions far ahead of the status of accumulated knowledge. And I wondered how you would weigh in on this. Secondly, just along those same lines, for example, comparing lemons to grapefruit is not the same thing as comparing size of brain and body mass ratios. You know, and so there's lots of ways science causes a bias about the achievements it accomplishes in relationship to a large history of practical knowledge about animals. And I just wonder what your thoughts on that were. And finally, I wondered what you think the most important counterintuitive discoveries neuroscience has made about dogs that dog owners and dog trainers thought was certainly true. Thank you very much. I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer.
All right. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Okay. Quite a lot there.
Yeah.
So I think when talking about practical knowledge, we have to acknowledge that that's not, you know, science does not, you know, operate that way with practical knowledge. So science is, of course, based on essentially the scientific method where, you know, we try to control as many factors as possible. We, you know, we have some hypothesis, then we try to isolate the dimensions that we're interested in the particular experiment and then do that and try to obtain as objective data as possible while controlling for many of the unknowns. Now, it's never perfect. We can't ever do the perfect experiment. But the key thing is that we are doing a particular intervention, if you will. You know, so we present something very specifically to dogs, or we ask them to do something very specifically in that context. So that's in contrast to kind of a different form of knowledge, which you mentioned as practical knowledge, which is very hard to objectify because it's not typically based on controlled studies. It could be biased samples. And as we all know, there are, frankly, different schools of thought in dog training, which to me look very much like religions almost. The different schools often have very dogmatic ways of doing things. So now, you know, there's the all-positive movement, which is in contrast to what was very popular years ago, dominance theories of dog training. And so I don't think they're the same thing. I'm not going to discount practical knowledge, but just point out that it's not typically done in a controlled experiment fashion. And so I do think that science has something to say. Now, it may confirm what many trainers and just kind of everyday dog owners already know, but so what? I mean, it's still important because, you know, understanding how the brain gives rise to internal states, emotions, and behavior is important just for the knowledge itself, and it may yield practical benefits later. So this experiment I described about impulse control is that kind of example, because now by understanding, okay, well, how does a dog actually put on the brakes and stop itself from doing something that it might want to but it knows it's not supposed to? Well, that has practical implications for training because it suggests that if there's a common neural structure for that, then maybe various tasks that can kind of strengthen that structure and the function of that structure may have spillover into other aspects of the dog's life.
I wonder, someone mentioned something about dogs smiling and whether dogs can smile or not. And I swear my last dog, at first I used to think it was a grimace, but it finally, I connected the dots and I was sure she was smiling when she would see certain people.
There is absolutely something, and actually many animals do this. It's called a submissive grin. And you can Google that and you'll see exactly what it looks like. And dogs, some dogs do this. So I have one dog in the house that does this. And it's actually, if you don't know what the dog is doing, it can often be mistaken for a grimace, like they're going to attack.
It's kind of weird looking, yeah.
Yeah, and
like they're baring in their teeth.
Absolutely, and chimpanzees do this as well. And it's called a submissive grin because it's an appeasement expression. And then there's subtle differences in exactly how they pull back their lips that is different than if they're going to bite. And if you can't tell the difference, it's easy to confuse the two.
You know, we had the question about whether they're. What makes a dumb dog? What makes a smart dog? Are there breeds? Do we know there are breeds that just tend to be more classically intelligent as we think of it?
Well, that's hard to say. Again, it's like I don't have a good way of measuring intelligence.
Yeah.
Really. So, border collies are always at the top of that list. But they do different things than other dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So does that make them smarter? I don't think so. Maybe the smartest dog is the one who gets their human to do everything.
Right, exactly. Let's see. Sharon in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Burns, we just recently rescued, about 6 months ago, a 10-and-a-half-year-old darling female beagle. And she is the sweetest thing ever until we have to leave. My daughter takes her to daycare every day. But when we're home with her, even if I walk her, she's pooped, she's peed, she's done everything. We've given her tons of attention and I leave for 45 minutes. When we come back, she is so traumatized and she'll pee and she howls like crazy when you come back in, which we've learned to ignore. But how do we help comfort this poor dog?
Yeah, that's a tough one. So separation anxiety is a real thing. It could be age related, but it may not be. I think if she's getting the doggy daycare, that helps. But probably a approach where you kind of acclimate her to being left alone for, initially short periods of time and then gradually lengthening it. So you can perhaps get her used to that on the weekend or something like that. That's just a guess, though.
Yeah. Thanks, Sharon, for that call. Liz in Ross County, you're on the air. Hi, Liz.
Oh, hi. I just have a quick question. I wondered about how dogs, I've heard the theory that dogs perceive time through smell as opposed to humans who perceive time through sight, rising and setting in the sun. And I wonder, do they learn our sense of time or is that even a correct theory?
Yes, so there's a little data on that. I mean, whether they perceive time through the sense of smell, that's speculation. It's certainly possible. But, dogs, like every other animal on this planet, has ingrained and essentially hardwired clock mechanisms. So every dog can tell kind of broadly across a day, what time it is because they can see the light changing. So they have this sense that, when the light is this way in the morning, this happens, during midday, maybe there's nobody home, and then, the people come back when the light is this other way. So they have these diurnal rhythms. They have their own circadian rhythms, so they can tell and mark time by whether they're hungry or not. They can mark time by their bladder filling up. So they have the ability to kind of tell that time is passing in the broad sense. What we don't know is kind of in the fine-grained ways, can they tell, the difference between seconds and minutes and hours? Probably not. that great? And can they tell, you know, days to weeks to months? And we don't really know, because that's very difficult to test.
Thanks a lot, Liz. Appreciate your call. I'm wondering how this has changed you as a dog lover over all this time working with dogs in this way. What has it meant?
Well, I was just at a canine science conference this weekend, and you know, we heard things, you know, about, I mean, we do the brain imaging. We also heard talks about genetics and the origin of dogs, and you can sit there and do all this science, and you know, we're learning a tremendous amount about them, and it doesn't take one iota away from how utterly wonderful these animals are. And if anything, just learning all this about them just makes me love them more.
I was really taken with your writings about your work on dolphins and dolphin brains. You were able to study some very old brains that had been left in formaldehyde. What do they tell us about all of this?
So we're trying to start to piece together, you know, by brains, what in this particular brain, say, makes a dog, or a wolf, or even a tiger, and so by studying these old brains that have essentially been disembodied because the owners are now dead, we're trying to build a digital database so we can actually start to compare brains to each other. And the amazing thing is, when we look at, you know, the brains of mammals, there are lots of similarities, and then there are very subtle differences. And so the hope is, by, you know, accumulating enough data, we'll start to figure this out, you know, specifically, you know, not just size, but how specific parts are connected to each other.
And what was interesting to me is how even these brains that had been in formaldehyde or wherever, however they've been preserved for as long as a decade, still told you, gave you a lot of information.
It is. So actually, the oldest specimen we studied is over a century old. And so there's the brain of what used to be called the Tasmanian tiger, which lived in Tasmania, and has been extinct for almost 100 years. And we found the Smithsonian actually has an intact brain of one of them that had been there since, it was like 1905. And so they lent it to us to study, and we used somewhat different MRI techniques, but we were actually able to reconstruct the internal structure of the brain. It's remarkable.
And the way you even learned something from how much the preservative, what it could get to and what it couldn't get to, the brains are shaped differently?
Well, yeah, and that was the Tasmanian tiger is actually a marsupial, so more closely related to opossums, although their outward appearance was that they looked like dogs or coyotes. And so we looked at the brain to try to understand, you know, well, if their outward appearance was dog-like, was their brain dog-like? And the answer is no, not really. It actually is quite different looking. And so we were able to draw some conclusions about that from, you know, maybe what their social life might have been like if they had any at all, which probably they were not very social species.
You've seen the shame photos on the, you know, they go viral sometimes, the dog saying, you know, I thought I was having a good time with the toilet paper. It turns out, you know, blah, 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 on YouTube videos and that kind of a thing. And dogs look guilty. You wrote about that a little bit, didn't you?
A little bit, you know, and this is debatable, you know, kind of how much shame and guilt dogs have. So what I'll say is that to feel shame and guilt requires a fairly sophisticated cognitive ability. So you have to remember what you did. You have to know that you weren't supposed to do that. And then you have to realize that there are consequences for that, and to care about that. So it's a little bit unclear how much of that dogs do versus simply just reacting to the fact that the person's yelling at them. We'll see.
In the next book. Dr. Gregory Burns, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Gregory Burns, his book is entitled What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. Thanks for listening today. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.